approved member of the U.S. military is to be straight, white, Christian nationalist, and male. So why is anybody surprised that with that template going down in a hierarchical organization, tribal, adversarial, communal, and ritualistic, like the U.S. military, that you have subordinate commanders, all of whom are trying to get promoted, that are following the exact same thing? We saw this happen before when the Israeli Defense Forces moved into Gaza and started attacking the Palestinians. We had, in a much smaller way, we had commanders saying, well, this is also sparking the Battle of Armageddon. But whenever you attach an extremist aspect of any religious faith to that machinery, Amy, of the faith responsible for war, we do not end up with little creeks, streams, ponds, or lakes, Amy. We end up with one thing, oceans and oceans of blood, like the color of my shirt.
We have 20 seconds. What risks do service members face for reporting religious comments made by U.S. commanders?
If they do that officially, they become essentially what we call a tarantula on a wedding cake. Amy, you and I have been to lots of weddings. Tarantulas on wedding cakes, that doesn't bode well for the tarantula or the wedding cake.
Mikey Weinstein, founder and president of Military Religious Freedom Foundation, speaking to us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that does it for our show. Produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Do you like discovering new music and reconnecting with some older but perhaps forgotten favorites? Then look no further. Tune into The Listening Room with host Timothy P. every other Thursday at 3 in the morning for a genre-bending 2.5-hour show where you never know what you might hear next, but you will be sure to be engaged and entertained.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon legislature ended its short session late last week.
A collective bargaining agreement between the WNBA and its players' union comes down to the wire.
And in national news, Democratic lawmakers continue to block DHS funding as the partial government shutdown grinds into its fourth week.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 9th, 2026. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. The Oregon legislature ended its 2026 short session last Friday after 5 weeks of work despite of a couple of brief Republican walkouts. Lawmakers successfully passed several high-profile bills, including a Measure Senate Bill 1599 that moves a voter referendum on the new transportation taxes and fees from the November general election to the May primary. Governor Tina Kotek and lawmakers are locked in a struggle to address a $300 million transportation budget shortfall. Democrats believe that moving the vote to May allows Oregonians to make their voices heard sooner rather than later. Republicans called the change political strategizing, saying fewer Oregonians will participate. Republicans filed a lawsuit to block the measure that is currently set for the May 19th primary. Senate Bill 1501, the bipartisan effort to keep the Trailblazers as the primary tenant of the MOTA Center, authorizes $200 million in state debt to upgrade the arena, with an additional $165 million directed to the project over the next two-year budget. Top Democrats say that music performers and jock tax on NBA and WNBA players' salaries will repay the money previously destined for Oregon's general fund. Oregon legislatures also passed bills aimed at curbing federal government overreach and aggressive immigration enforcement tactics. One bill allows Oregonians to sue federal agents for violating their Fourth Amendment rights, and another bans face coverings for law enforcement. Another establishes protections for immigrants in hospitals, and SB 1587 protects immigrants' information from being sold by third parties to ICE. House Bill 4079 creates a statewide alert notification system to tell students and parents when immigration authorities are on school campuses. The Protect Your Door Act requires federal agents to have a warrant signed by a judge when they enter private property, a hospital, school, or church. Over 2,000 Oregonians have been arrested in Oregon since Trump took office, many of them radically profiled on the street and kidnapped by federal agents.
The Oregon Department of Transportation was facing a major budget shortfall that state lawmakers had to address this session. Lawmakers cut or redirected $290 million in services as the agency focused on core functions. As a result, Oregonians will see reduced transportation services in the coming months, ranging from longer wait times at the DMV to fewer street safety projects. Office of Government Relations Director Sam Chase updated the Portland City Council Transportation Committee on the session earlier today.
Short sessions are typically times to adjust for budget, and this was one that really went much further than that in many ways. The legislature was charged with identifying $288 million in cuts with ODOT. There are some vacancies that are going to continue at ODOT to help mitigate the budget. There were some funding cuts to Safe Routes to School, which is a very important program for the city, and that those funds were cut in half by $17 million. The Connect Oregon was cut entirely. That's $42 million. That is funding for trains, planes, and marine. So those are, you know, funds that we could otherwise maybe be accessing for things like Union Station. So there are not cuts to existing funds that we have right now, but those are opportunities lost potentially. They are not intended to be long term. They are intended to be temporary cuts that would be restored with a package. There was also a community pass program that was cut $8 million from that, and that's for things like trails. So there are opportunities lost there that could be impactful, but we don't see any dollars that are direct cuts coming to the city from the package.
Government Relations Director Sam Chase says the city will be gearing up for a new transportation package in the long session in 2027. Council Vice President Olivia Clark and Councilor Anelita Murillo expressed dismay about losing the Safe Routes to School funding. Safe Routes to Schools refer to road upgrades and other projects that encourage kids to walk or bike to school. Murillo says the local transportation system is suffering, and it's disappointing to see a lack of support at the state level.
I'm really devastated to hear that some things like Safe Routes to Schools didn't get funding. I think it's absolutely absurd and frustrating that at this time where driving is going to become more expensive, the cost of gas is going to go up, and people desperately need public transit options, they need Safe Routes to Schools, they need things like that, that it feels like our legislators who are in a higher office than us, where the money ends up impacting us at the local level, are not meeting the moment in that way. So for any legislators that are listening, we will hold you to making sure that you are going to invest in public infrastructure. We desperately need it. I will personally be naming the folks that are fighting for those things, who did care about those things, and the folks who let those things fall through the cracks. Because at the local level, we are struggling very much because the federal government and then our state legislators are choosing not to invest in these things, and there's only so much we can do at the city level. I'm grateful for your work, not at all. Just expressing frustration to any legislators that are listening that I demand that we have public infrastructure funded. And as someone who relies on transit as well, because I can't drive, it's just immensely frustrating to see key things, especially in my district, that are very precious to them that are being cut.
That was Portland City Councilor Annalita Murillo speaking at the Council Transportation Committee meeting this morning.
The WNBA's newest franchises, the Portland Fire and Toronto Tempo, haven't chosen a single player in the league's diversal draft yet, but there's a chance their seasons could be delayed. Negotiations on a collective bargaining agreement between the WNBA and the Players Union, the WNBPA, face a Tuesday deadline with both sides dug into their prospective positions. The sticking point, revenue sharing. The union's last few proposals have offered roughly 70% of net revenue, with that number increasing as the league continues to grow. WNBA's Caitlin Clark said at USA Basketball training camp on Saturday that, quote, the two sides should stop sending proposals and instead meet face-to-face until a deal gets done. Clark went on to say, I don't understand why we don't just get in a room and iron it out and shake hands. That's how business is. You look at each other in the eye, you shake hands, you respect both sides. For me, that's what I'd love to see, end quote. The union's previous proposal asked for an average of 26% of the gross revenue, that's revenue before expenses, over the course of the agreement. That includes only 25% of the first year of the new deal. WNBA League negotiators said that the number was unrealistic. If a labor deal is agreed to by Tuesday, March 10th, it would likely be signed by the end of the month. Under that timeline, the expansion draft for new franchises in Portland and Toronto would be held sometime between April 1st and April 6th. Free agents, qualifying offers, and franchise player tags would be sent out April 7th to April 8th, when WNBA teams would then have for 3 days to negotiate with more than 80% of the players who are free agents. Final league negotiations would wrap up in mid-April and training camps to follow, and the new season set to begin on May 8th.
A wave of financial anxiety is sweeping across a key group of voters heading into the next election cycle, women over 50. A new survey from AARP finds just over half of older women say they feel less financially secure than they did a year ago. Fewer than half feel confident they'll have enough money to live comfortably throughout retirement. KBOO's Carmel Pierre-Louis reports.
Older women report significantly greater financial insecurity than their male counterparts, especially women ages to 50 to 64, according to new data. The report released by AARP found fewer than half of women over 50 feel confident they will have enough money to live comfortably in retirement. Stacy Triplett with AARP, Oregon, says the rising cost of living is behind much of the anxiety.
They're feeling things like not being on target for the savings that they'd like to have at this time facing retirement or for emergency expenses. They're also reporting that they're concerned about Social Security and Medicare being available.
Triplett says this data should not be ignored, in part because women over 50 are reliable voters, making up more than a quarter of the electorate in 2024. She says candidates must address the financial stress and lack of opportunity that many older women face. Research shows despite wage gains, a woman still earns about 84 cents to every dollar a man makes. And in Oregon, more than half of women over 50 are current or former unpaid caregivers for an adult family member, which adds to economic stress. The survey also identifies healthcare as a major financial pressure point. Triplett says it is forcing older women to make difficult trade-offs.
Most concerningly, folks have reported that they're skipping medical care or going into debt or reducing or skipping required medication because of the costs.
Although many causes of economic stress are a result of inequality, research shows that women in the U.S. also have a lower rate of financial literacy, regardless of education level. Triplett says AARP is helping to even the playing field by hosting a free Women's Financial Skills Workshop online on March 26. For KBOO News and Oregon News Service, I'm Carmel Pierre-Louis.
Kristi Noem is fired from her position as Homeland Security Secretary, but moves to a new and unclear role. The Senate Majority Leader blames Democrats for the ongoing DHS shutdown, and the House fails to advance a war's power resolution for Iran. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're going to have to secure our border and make sure we're going after dangerous criminal illegals and remove them from our country. And every day, we're going to have to make tough decisions to uphold the law, to make sure the consequences for breaking the law are put in place as well.
After a harsh grilling in the Senate, Kristi Noem has been fired as Homeland Security Secretary. She led President Donald Trump's mass deportation effort, but was criticized when agents killed two Minnesota protesters, whom she falsely called domestic terrorists. Senators also accused her of mismanagement, delaying emergency relief contracts while spending extravagantly, including $200 million for ads telling people without legal status to leave the country voluntarily. Trump tapped Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen to replace her. Noem is moving to an as-yet-undefined role as special envoy to a new effort called the Shield of the Americas. Congress is no closer to funding her old department. Since the Minneapolis shootings, Democrats have demanded reforms, notably a uniform code of conduct for federal agents requiring body cameras but forbidding masks. Senate Majority Leader John Thune calls it a political ploy.
If Democrats really wanted to put reforms in place, they'd be doing everything they can to get a bill. Of course, the White House isn't going to sign off on every Democrat demand. No side gets everything it wants in negotiations.
House Democrats have introduced a bill to fund all DHS agencies with the exception of ICE and CBP. Connecticut Democratic Representative Rosa DeLauro says the Speaker is preventing it from getting a vote, instead favoring the agency's, quote, lawlessness. DeLauro and other Democrats say the Republicans would rather have immigration as an issue than work to fix it. She points to a bipartisan border security compromise reached at the end of the Biden administration, which died when Thune and almost all Republicans voted against it at the request of then-candidate Trump. North Carolina's Senate race is already heating up as Democratic former Governor Roy Cooper prepares to face former Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Whatley. Both of the state's current senators are Republicans, but Kirk Beto with Insider Politics website The Hotline says Democrats like their chances in the battleground.
Governor Roy Cooper has never lost a statewide election. He has all that money on hand. He left relatively very popular in North Carolina, too, which is saying something in a 50-50 state like that.
Both the House and the Senate have now failed to pass war powers resolutions that would limit Trump's authority to attack Iran. A handful of Republicans did support the House version, including isolationist Republican Kentucky Representative Thomas Massie.
Why are we going to war with Iran? We owe our military service members a clear mission. And American families in my district want to know how this is going to help them pay for groceries.
Iran is continuing its own attacks in more than a dozen countries, including most of the Gulf region. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, listen in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, expect the chance of a wintry mix as the snow level drops to about 500 feet tonight and early tomorrow morning. Low temperatures will be roughly 32 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, look for mostly cloudy conditions with the mixed rain and snow showers early. High temperatures 47 or thereabouts. Today in history, March 9th, 1979, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bowie Kuhn says Major League Baseball teams must allow equal access to team locker rooms to all reporters, regardless of their gender. The quote of the day is from American author, public speaker, and actor Fran Lebowitz, who said, quote, "In real life, I assure you, there is no such thing as algebra." End quote.
With a fresh blanket of snow on their trail, five indigenous mushers and their dog teams are headed to Nome, Alaska. The 1,000-mile Iditarod race got underway in Willow, north of Anchorage, yesterday. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Five indigenous mushers and their dog teams are headed to Nome. The 1,000-mile race got underway in Willow, north of Anchorage, on Sunday. A fresh blanket of snow covered the trail. Two of the top contenders in a field of 37 mushers are Alaska Native. Ryan Reddington, an Inupiaq musher from Kinnick, won the race in 2023. Pete Kaiser, a Yupik from Bethel, took the title in 2019. Kaiser skipped last year's Iditarod and hadn't planned to race this year until 3 weeks ago, following his historic 10th win of the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race. After Kaiser set the record for winning the most Cusco 300s, he says returning to the Iditarod felt like the right decision.
By the time the Cusco's over, you know, you've done 90% of the work, started training in July, and so I just felt like things were looking okay and felt like going down the trail again, so here we are.
There are three indigenous rookies in the race to watch. Jesse Terry, an Anishinaabe musher from Sioux Lookout, Ontario, is a veteran of several mid-distance races. He's been mushing dogs since he was 11 years old. Another rookie, Kevin Hansen, an Inupiaq from Kotzebue, has been sprint racing since the third grade. He finished second in last year's Kobuk 440, just behind defending Iditarod champ Jesse Holmes. But for Hansen, this race is about more than competition.
Part of who I am as an Inupiaq, and you really feel it out there and times when it's just you, your dogs, and the land, and dealing with the elements and challenges.
This may be Jody Potts Joseph's first Iditarod, but the Han Guichin from Eagle Village is well known. She starred in the TV show Life Below Zero, First Alaskans, and her daughter Kwana Chasing Horse is an indigenous model, featured in magazines like Vogue. Together, they've been outspoken environmental advocates.
Why mushing out of all the spectrum of things I do? It's because that's really where my heart is. Love the dogs. I love being out on the land with the dogs. I mean, it fills my soul and it just gives me a lot of purpose.
Potts Joseph says it's been a tough training season. Interior Alaska temperatures dropped down to 30 to 65 below this winter, too cold for her dogs to run safely. Her main goal, to finish the Iditarod with a healthy team. The first finishers are expected to cross the finish line next Monday or Tuesday. The federal government is encouraging tribes to partner with data centers. That could mean leasing land or, as the Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports, selling power.
At a U.S. Department of Energy webinar, Ken Aumann with Colusa Indian Energy said that's where the big bucks come in.
Potentially billions of dollars into the coffers of tribes.
His company provides energy infrastructure to data centers on tribal land. He says these partnerships can be good for tribes that have land and resources to power big projects, like the Osage Nation in Oklahoma. Paul Beemore is the chair of the tribe's utility board.
Tribes that are casino dependent really need to look at other ways to build their economies, and I think that data centers is one of those opportunities.
Though Beemore says people may be wary about how this will impact the environment. Other tribes have expressed concerns about data centers draining precious water supplies. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Americans are, by and large, not significantly impacted by the government shutdown. But that is not true for people trying to travel in the southern or the southeastern U.S. Airport travelers experienced long waits over the weekend, some lasting hours. Officials blamed the long TSA checkpoint lines on the government shutdown affecting on the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The estimated wait time at the standard security checkpoint at the William P. Hobby Airport in Houston early Sunday evening was 3 hours. The airport reported on social media changing recommendations from urging travelers to arrive early to asking them to arrive 3 to 4 hours before their flights. Eventually, travelers were asked to arrive 4 to 5 hours early. Posts from New Orleans International Airport urged travelers to arrive at least 3 hours before their flights and said wait times could last up to 2 hours. They warned similar delays could continue throughout the coming week. It's not clear whether delays in Houston and New Orleans were happening at other airports around the country. The weekend's longer than usual wait time came on top of recent flight delays placed in places like Atlanta due to the weather. Agents with the U.S. Transportation Security Administration have been working without pay during the ongoing shutdown of the department, which began February 14th. Democratic lawmakers are standing firm and saying DHS will not receive funding until new restrictions are placed on federal immigration operations, following the fatal shootings of Alex Preti and Renee Good in Minneapolis.
A new report from the Environmental Protection Network, a nonprofit composed of former staff at the Environmental Protection Agency, calls out the Trump administration's moves to roll back protections against toxic chemicals. It also lists the top 12 pollutants in the U.S. KBOO's Carmel Pierre-Louis has more on the story.
A new report calls out the Trump administration's many efforts to roll back pollution protections, warning that an increased exposure to toxic chemicals is hazardous to human health in Nevada and across the U.S. The Terrible Toxic Situation Report is a part of the Safer, Not Sicker campaign from the Environmental Protection Network, a nonprofit made up of former staff at the Environmental Protection Agency. Sarah Biosik, a registered nurse with the Nonpartisan Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments, says the current EPA has abandoned its mission by delaying or limiting health safeguards on toxic chemicals in our air, water, and land.
We know that more soot in the air will mean more children treated for asthma and lung diseases. More lead will result in children with developmental problems. More benzene will lead to higher rates of blood cancers, including lymphoma. More TCE will contribute to kidney and liver cancers, Parkinson's disease, and fetal heart defects.
The EPA under President Trump has worked to weaken many environmental protection standards, arguing that they cost jobs by placing too high of a burden on businesses, agriculture, and manufacturing. The report names 12 most common ways Americans are exposed to toxic chemicals and specifically mentions arsenic, which is a particular problem in unregulated private water wells, the Reno-Truckee Meadows area. The Trump administration is petitioning a federal court to roll back the Biden-era standards on particular matters in the air. Dr. Afi El Hassan, a pediatrician on the board of the American Lung Association, says that will lead to dirtier air, especially in neighborhoods near freeways and industrial zones.
When the EPA weakens the guardrails to keep soot out of children's air, it means more kids in the emergency room struggling to breathe. It means more missed school days and more missed work days for the parents that have to stay home and take care of the children.
The authors also call out mercury in fish, pesticides on our food, phthalates in plastic packaging, lead in paint, soil and water, and PFAS, forever chemicals in drinking water and in dust, especially near military bases. The report also examines excessive exposure to TCE, formaldehyde, benzene, and vinyl chloride. For KBOO News and Public News Service, I'm Carmel Pierre-Louis.
Wild rice, central to Anishinaabe culture, is shrinking as climate change and pollution take a toll. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Every year, Leanna Goose canoes into the shallow bays near her Minnesota home to harvest wild rice, or monomin, as the region's indigenous Anishinaabe people call it.
It's something that we have been doing for generations, and it's really central to who we are as Anishinaabe here in Minnesota.
Goose is a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. She recalls the rice bed where her parents took her as a child.
I remember that rice bed being so abundant and expansive that, like, I lost my parents on it. Like, you couldn't even see across it.
Now, she says, it's less than half the size it once was. Manoman is threatened by invasive species, disease, development, and climate change. Research shows that rice beds tend to be sparser in years with less winter ice and more spring rain.
We're seeing loss of Manoman or wild rice, not only here in Minnesota, but across the region.
So she and others are pushing for legislation that recognizes Manoman's cultural significance and puts stricter regulations on boating and water pollution in areas where they harm wild rice to help protect this sacred food. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, March 9th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Carmel, Pierre-Louis, Dave Johnson, Althea Billings, and Josh Salem. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Jacob Earle. Special thanks to Edward J. Vieira, Jill Freitas, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.